Adonai Eloheinu Aleinu Maaseh Nerukh Nunah Aleinu Maaseh Nerukh Nunehu. Tonight, we're going to discuss a topic. I've advertised it as the mysteries of Genesis, what really happened in the beginning. Now, Genesis in the Jewish tradition is actually the first six chapters of the book of Genesis. We call it Parasha Bereshit. It's the Torah portion which is read at the beginning of the cycle of the Torah reading cycles, which in our calendar begins this week. All six chapters cover so much material that on the first three chapters alone, I just briefly covered 6 hours of work on it. So tonight, I am not going to review all of Parsha Bereshit. We're not going to discuss Adam, the fall, Cain and Abel, a separate tape series of 6 hours. For those who are interested, I'll reference you there. Tonight, we're actually going to discuss what I guess is referred to as cosmology. We really want to understand anything about who and what we are today. And we have to understand the very, 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 very beginning. And so it is in modern science. The great search is for what they will call the grand unified theory. In other words, what makes life tick? What are we all about? Why is this important? Well, because as human beings, we all know there's something in us that is craving, thirsty, to connect with dot, 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 fill in the blank, whatever that with is. In religion, we refer to it as God. In science, they might refer to it as the universe or to wisdom. But we know there's something beyond our horizon. And it seems to be inherent within our species to be overwhelmingly curious as to explore our origins. It does appear to us that this is a aspect unique to our species. When was the last time you found a dolphin or a monkey that was interested in subatomic physics and wanted to discover the origins of the universe? No. And they might have intelligence or spirit or whatever they might or may not have, but we find that this inquisitiveness is unique to us. Kabbalists say that the reason for this is because we as human beings are not unique and limited to the physical plane, but that we are actually dual creatures, a creature of flesh and blood and a creature of light. But the minute that we start talking about light, spirit, we automatically jump into the realm of what I refer to as religious mythology. What is spirit? What is light? If we want to point to light, you're going to point to the light bulb that's shining in this room. That's not light. From a scientific point of view, light is invisible. You cannot see light. All you see is the reflections or refractions of light. Now that should make us think that if we refer to God in the spirit realm as light, and if we cannot see light, then also we can't see the spirit world. It is just as invisible. So for example, when I hold up my hand and my hand is visible to us, you see my hand, you see the pigmentation of the color of my flesh. But what actually you are seeing is the refraction of light off of my hand, which is reflecting its molecular makeup and its chemical makeup, which is refracting light within a specific wavelength, which we call color. Is my hand really this color? No, it's not. Actually, color is an illusion within the context of refracted light. And the proof of this is something which we call nighttime. Go out in pitch dark at night, and all colors look alike. Why? Because there is no color. It's the old question. If a tree falls in a forest and no one is there to hear it crash, does it make a noise? Well, that's a good question, being that if you're there to hear it, it makes a noise that you hear, we can't tell. But at night, when there is no refraction of light, technically there is no color. The color exists only in the potential of the object, but not in the object itself. Let's discuss light. Let's go back to the beginning. In the beginning, the Arizal, Rabbi Isaac Luria, discusses Kabbalistic teachings from the beginning. And it says, in the beginning, prior to creation, there is God. I could say was God. Remember, God was, is, and forevermore will be, so we always speak in the present tense. There is God in the beginning. Prior to any manifest creation, at this beginning phase, God is called the Or Ein Sof, which means the light without end. And the light is said to be a pure and simple light without any differentiation whatsoever. So, how would we want to portray God in the beginning? Pure, unadulterated light. How do you want to look at light? Again, goes back to this question. Is light, if I normally think of light, you think of a white. Think of the color white, brilliance. But what you're seeing there is the refraction or reflection of light. What color is light in and of itself? You ever see a laser beam pointer? Those that are very popular today, has a laser beam, shines a red dot. They're also used in target shooting. If light was visible, how come you don't see a beam of red light go out? All you see is the dot. If it was a dusty room, then the light would shine and show up the dust particles, but otherwise, the light itself is invisible. So God in the beginning is pure, unadulterated light. The language of the Kabbalah and the words of the Ari here now become highly metaphorical. The language is like this. There arose a desire in the primordial creator to be called by his names. And this desire arose from the center of this light without end. And therefore, from this very center point of this infinite light, God withdrew an aspect of his light, condensed into himself, creating an empty space. That is how we would translate the words of the Zohar, of the Kabbalah. But now, what on earth does any of that really mean? You have light. There arose a desire, an undifferentiated light. If it's undifferentiated, meaning that everything is the same, second law of thermodynamics, everything seeks to be completely equal. Well, if everything is completely equal, then you can have no desire. Desire would be like a blip. It would be a high point. You can't have it because everything is unadulterated. Everything's the same. So the concept to think that there can be a change is in and of itself contradictory. And then we say that this desire, this change which cannot be, arose in the center of the infinite light without end. Tell me, where is the center of infinity? I've never figured that one out yet. And I don't know the greatest of all scientific minds if they've ever figured that one out yet. It is very interesting. But now in mathematical principles, they actually have different multiple levels of infinity. I forget the mathematician's name, but he refers to the different levels of infinity by the Hebrew letter Aleph. Standard infinity is Aleph 0. And then you can have subsets of infinity. Aleph 1, Aleph 2, Aleph 3, infinity 1, infinity 2, infinity 3. This is very advanced mathematics, but this is there. What on earth does this mean? Kabbalah says that a desire arose, and in the center of infinity, in the unadulterated light. There arose a desire to be called by your names. God didn't have a name at this time. What names are we talking about here? Again, we see a language of metaphor. This becomes very important to understand, because many people, when they study Kabbalah, mistake the metaphor for reality. All right? Now, just as a word of warning for all you hearing those guys on tape, it's an old Eastern traditional teaching. They say a finger points to the moon to discuss matters of truth. But just as there is a great distance between the finger and the moon to which it points, so is there a great distance between words and to the truths to which they point. The right lesson is, don't mistake the finger for the moon. Don't mistake words for the truths to which they point. In other words, recognize the abstractness. At the end of the Torah, the end of the book of Deuteronomy, Moses sings a poem to the children of Israel. Some interpret that poem to be exclusively Deuteronomy chapter 30. Others interpret it as being the entire Torah, as being a poem. And a poem, we know, is not prose, and therefore must be understood as a metaphor instead of as an outright description. So in all due respect, anyone who wishes to try to understand the Bible, or for that matter the Kabbalah literally, by definition is off base. So, nowhere do we see this clearer as we discuss the matter of the beginning in the Kabbalah. Now let's try to understand this as best as we can. First, where is God in the beginning, the Ein Sof? We say everywhere. It is beyond the concept of space. We say that the universe is inside God, but God is not inside the universe. In other words, God is the place of the universe, but the universe is not the place of God. What that really means, I don't know if any of us can say. What really is God? I don't know if any of us can say, or for that matter, will ever be able to say. To think of God in the anthropomorphic form of a little old man with a white beard sitting on a cloud somewhere is religious mythology, and forbidden by the second commandment of the Ten Commandments, shall not make a graven image. Really, shall not have another God upon my face. Shall not conceive of any thought and function of that in God. God is completely abstract. We might as well as refer to God as the ultimate mathematical principle. But we say, but I have a relationship with the Lord. But of course you do. But do you think that the minuscule way of how you and I perceive God is how God is in reality? I don't think so. There arose a desire in the center. Where is the center of infinity? Well, it all depends on how you're going to define the word center. Are you going to define that within the concept of proximity of location, physically? If you are, you cannot. It is an impossible task because there's no space at this point. There is no time at this point. So this answers the age-old question, how come God created the universe when he did it not before? And the answer is, well, that was the beginning of time. There was no before. And whenever before would be, that's the time of creation. And just how long ago creation occurred, we'll discuss as we move along. So here we have a desire in the center of creation. The way that the Kabbalists explain this center is not being at a physical place, but rather there arose a transformation from what we can today call potential into actuality. We know from science what's called the Big Bang. All of a sudden there's this Big Bang. Boom! Well, Big Bangs occur for reasons. How does an explosion occur? When you have properties of two varying natures which either combine or break, releasing at a molecular or atomic level the energies which are inherent within those structures. For example, in an atomic bomb made from uranium. Uranium is a molecular structure, it's a molecule, which has protons and neutrons surrounded by electrons and all the rest, which is very weak and unstable. The neutrons and the protons in the nucleus of the atom of the uranium are held together with the electrons all around it. The electrons is the energy. If the neutrons and the protons in that nucleus are broken, then the energy which holds them together is no longer needed, and it's released. That release, that break of that molecule, is what we call an atomic explosion, where in which science, through whatever explosive device, blows off a chemical device, shooting other types of particles into the nucleus of uranium, causing the breakup of the neutrons and the protons. They separate, the energy releases, atom bomb explosion. That's how the science of it works. Now let's go back to the Big Bang. Something existed in the beginning which separated. Now we're not talking here at the level of particles. There's nothing physical here at this time. But what separated, the Kabbalists refer to as the language of desire. That there arose a desire. There was a separation between potential and actuality. And they refer to it as a contraction. Interesting how science says you had a point and everything exploded from the point. The Kabbalists say there arose a desire at the central point and then withdrew from it. But from the space around it, it's a contraction inward. But it's the same function. One looks like it's going out, the other one looks like it's moving into the outer space. So here we see that science and Kabbalah are actually teaching one and the same thing. But what really happened? I don't know if anybody can say. I can read to you the latest of molecular subatomic particle physics, for example, Michio Kaku's book, Hyperspace, where he speaks about the 10-dimensional reality, which is actually the 26-dimensional reality, which we will discuss as we move along. And mind you, this is science, not Kabbalah, super string theory. But before we get to there, we have this creation, this beginning, the genesis of finite time and space. For what purpose? Science cannot say. And why not? Because in order to know the end of a thing, you must know the beginning of a thing. Science is as if groping out there, looking up, picking up whatever pieces they can, kind of like pieces of a puzzle, and fitting them in one by one to try to get the pieces, the puzzle together. But they don't have a picture of what it's supposed to look like. From a Torah perspective, we do have the greater picture. So when the pieces of the puzzle come, we know, you know, this kind of piece looks like it fits in here, and this one fits in there, so that we can create the greater picture. So here, this is what we're discussing. There was a purpose of this transformation. In the words of the Kabbalists, it says that God can be called by his names. Quoting from the text, he says, because if there is no one to whom God can show mercy, how can he be called merciful? There's no one that he can be just, how can he be called the just? Now again, what does that mean? That somewhere within this undifferentiated light in the beginning, there existed potential which was not actual, that was not manifest. And that creation gave birth to manifestations of different aspects of what was once all the same. Now this becomes very important to understand in light of modern day physics. Modern day physics, what they call the superstring theory, hypothesizes like this. What's the essence of creation? What is creation made of? What is matter really made of? We're going to say atoms. Okay. What are atoms made of? Well, remember our high school physics class. There are neutrons, and there are protons, and there are electrons. Now they know that within neutrons and protons in the nucleus of an atom, there are these little things called quarks. And within the quarks, there are gluons and bluons and all these other particles. There's actually a book written by a scientist called The Zoo of Subatomic Particles, because they found all of these different ones. But now, a new theory has come forward, which has shocked the scientific world, because when a new theory comes forward in science, it kind of like, remember I said about the pieces not fitting in together? You have like two or three pieces put together, and therefore they want to make a hypothesis based on the whole. Normally, all the pieces don't fit in. With Einstein's theory of relativity, which is a great theory, not everything fit in. Newton, his theories, not everything fit in. Here comes this theory called superstring theory, and everything somehow fits into it. Kaku's book, and I'll explain to you who he is in a moment. All of subatomic particles, all of matter, are actually made up of these itsy-bitsy-bitsy little strings, which all they are vibrational harmonics, like different strings on a violin. One of the great theoretical physicists today is a professor, Michio Kaku. He wrote a book called Hyperspace, very famous book, a scientific odyssey through parallel universes, time warps, and the 10th dimension. Published by Doubleday, and what's the year this was published? 1994. Brilliant scholar, and he's writing here about these little itsy-bitsy strings, which are the form of matter. He says here, it's so incredibly tiny. You know, string theory answers the question that a string is each about 100 billion billion times smaller than a proton. It's vibrating. Each mode of vibration represents a distinct resonance or particle. In other words, what's really the difference between a quark, a neutron, or a proton, an electron? What is a neutron, proton, and electron? Remember how we looked at it in science, they had these like little balls, and they're all put together? So we would think that the neutron and proton are little balls. Itsy, bitsy, bitsy little balls. And you put all the balls together and it forms matter. They're saying that's not it at all. But all these little itsy, bitsy balls are actually sound, vibrations, that each harmonize at a different frequency. That's what he's saying here. He says that each particle, each mode of vibration represents a distinct resonance of particle. I'm quoting from his book, Hyperspace, page 153. All of the universe is a sound. And he even goes on and says here, making this correlation to a violin. Each subatomic particle corresponds to a distinct resonance that vibrates only at a distinct frequency. The string can vibrate at any of an infinite number of different frequencies. And he says the point is not which particles are the most fundamental, the smallest, but which frequencies are which. The particles of the universe are not by themselves fundamental, he writes. It's all in the thing. Here, somehow, we look at a point particle, we would actually see a small vibrating string. Matter is nothing but the harmonies created by this vibrating string. This is a physicist talking. Remember these words when we discuss Kabbalistic teachings. It says here, string theory fits everything. The universe itself, page 154, he says, could be comparable to a symphony. But a string must obey a large set of self-consistency conditions. The string, for example, cannot limit itself and move in just three and four dimensions. The self-consistency conditions force the string to move in specific numbers of dimensions. In fact, the only, in quotes, magic numbers allowed by string theory are 10 and 26 dimensions. And then he says here on page 155, string theory, therefore, is rich enough to explain all the fundamental laws of nature. Wow, that's pretty cool. But what does this have to do with Kabbalah? Everything. We jump to an ancient Hebrew text called the Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Formation. In it is described what's called the secrets of creation, Sodot of Maaseh Bereshit. In other words, how God created the world. The opening text states that God created the world with 10 sephirot and 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. The 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet are what? What is a letter? It's a sound, isn't it? How did God create the universe? What does the Bible teach us? He, what? Took a whole bunch of clay and molded it together? How did God create light? He said, he spoke. What did God speak? Words. What are words made up of? Letters, which are sounds, which are vibrations. Gee, am I studying now physics or am I studying now Kabbalah? My, how the tables have turned. And 4,000 years of wisdom come right back to the start. Now that we have this little spice, let's see where this takes us. Because again, remember, the Bible is not prose. It is metaphor. One of the best books written on this topic is written by a, I think he's an MIT physicist. He got his doctoral degree from MIT. As a professor, Gerald Schroederer, wrote a book which was famous a number of years ago called Genesis and the Big Bang. And a point that he postulates is that modern day physics and the Bible teach exactly the same thing, but in radically different metaphor. So for example, for those of you who might think that modern day science is literal, let's prove that it's not. What is the great theory of Einstein? E equals mc squared, right? Energy equals mass times the speed of light. So matter at the speed of light equals the energy that's it's in it. Now, what is the relationship of energy represented by the letter E to the shape of the letter E? We know what a letter E looks like. Does the shape of that letter represent and manifest anything to us about the nature of energy? No. It's a completely abstract symbol that we use arbitrarily within our language to represent something. So does the Bible. The Bible must be understood to have multiple levels. But why are there multiple levels? An interesting point that superstring theory brings down is that as the universe congealed into its present form of 10 dimensions, four of them became known to us, which we know is the three dimensions of space, height, depth, width, and time. Six dimensions, he says, folded over so small that we can't see them. But in essence, there are 10 dimensions. Now, there's even more interesting stuff to talk about. Going back to the creation, to the beginning, we have, remember, the big explosion. According to Kabbalah, the creation began by God taking some of his primordial light and bringing it back into that empty space which is created by the withdrawal, which we would call the Big Bang. This light that came into the empty space became the beginning of what we call creation. But what again is this light? What is the definition of light? What is light? Light is made up of protons. It's a proton beam. And what are protons? We just learned harmonies. This actually corresponds to an old teaching of the sages. The rabbis teach that God looked into the Torah and created the world. That God used the Torah as a blueprint to create the world. And that all the Torah is one long name of God. That the real way to look at the Torah, the five books of Moses, is to take away all the vowels of all the words and all the separations, take out all the punctuation, and stop reading it as chapters and verses and words, and look at it as one long code. And that's the name, in quotes, of God. But what's in a name? A name, unlike the letter E in energy for our Einsteinian theory, which is just an abstract symbol, In Hebrew, a name is a manifestation of the ultimate essence of a being. So, for example, what is the true name of humanity would be its DNA structure. With all the multi-million combinations of links on the, of the 23 chromosomes, that's the true name. And all of those different combinations, each combination is what we'll call a letter, a vibration, which put into different harmony spells a song. Letters combined and perform what we will call a word, and that word is your name. So the Torah is the name of God. The universe, therefore, and the harmony of the vibrational strings is God in manifestation. We represent that in Hebrew by God's Hebrew name Yud-Keh-Vav-Keh, which comes from the Hebrew word to be. And it actually means being in action. Light comes into the world. Now, what is light? What is, we're going to call photons, we're going to call vibrations, we're going to call the superstring theory. What is vibrating? That really is the next question. We want to say vibration, we understand that. What is vibrating? Light? No, lights. Lights made up of these vibrations. What is vibrating? Science cannot say. Torah can. The vibration, we say, is God. We can call it today life force. That which gives shape, being, definition. Did you ever stop really to think, what is gravity? I'm going to go and jump out the window, I'm going to fall to the earth, because there's such a thing as gravity. If I'm going to go flying in my starship out in outer space, I'm going to fly too close to a planet or a sun, it's going to suck me in, because there's something called gravity. Attraction. That there is a force which, if you come within its domain, draws you to it. If you really want to know the truth, sexual attraction between men and women is Kabbalistically viewed as just another form of gravity. Just as generic and nothing more spiritual. So, light. Life force, whatever we're going to define that as, because science hasn't touched on that yet, comes in into the universe. And very interestingly, the Kabbalists say that when the light came into the original universe, remember the original universe, God withdrew, created it like this big round circle. The light came in and filled the circle level by level, like layers of an onion. Whereas at the same time, the Kabbalists speak of the sephirotic pattern, as you can see I'm pointing to up there, where in which you have those little balls, look like little atoms, don't they? And you have a right column and a left column and a center column, wherein the Kabbalists say that these were the levels of manifestation of divine light in creation. We call them wisdom, understanding, etc. and so on. Topics of the spirit I've discussed at other times. I won't get into them now. Other than to say that the manifestation of God's light was an evolutionary process leading towards a complete manifestation of sentience and what we can call physicality. So you have light coming into this empty sphere in the form of spheres and in the form of columns. In Hebrew, that's called agulim for the spheres and yosher for the columns. And you want to know something? I remember reading in my physics books how the big discussion in physics is light a beam of particles or a wave? What's a particle? Remember particles, like the little balls? Is it a sphere? Remember we said that light came into the sphere in the form of spheres? That would be balls. That would be like particles. Or does it come in lines? Lines are like a wave. Even though the drawing of the spherot here, two-dimensional, looks up and down, actually they wave back and forth. It's almost like a lightning bolt or like a curving snake. Like a wave. So here we have particle and wave theory right in the original Torah, right in the original teachings of Kabbalah. Now, believe me, I'm only scratching the surface now. But for the sake of time, we have to move on. So again, we have the original light of God, whatever that is. It is a life force. It has attributes to it, which leads to the cultivation and development of life. And this is the great point where in which a Kabbalist or a rabbi will disagree with the scientist. A scientist will say, things happened haphazardly. As if to say that I took an atomic bomb, blew up the city of Chicago, everything went up in the air and came down just as it landed with that, you know, 10 times improved. I don't know how many bombs you're going to have to explode to have that to happen. That's not going to happen. Matter of fact, I think it was in Schroeder's book, Genesis and the Big Bang, they once tried to see how long it would take by haphazard chance to develop the most simplest of life, like a bacteria. And they say it would take over 10 billion years by chance. How long then would it take a more defined creation like a human to have developed? Longer than what they consider to be the age of the universe. So to think that things just happened, monkeys sitting around on typewriters and all of a sudden writing Shakespeare's sonnets, is not really a rational belief, but really a prejudiced belief that some in the scientific community will use so as to discount a concept of creator, so as to distance themselves from religion, the purpose of which is to deny mythology and to pursue truth. In other words, I don't think that the majority of scientific pursuit in this respect is anti-religious, specifically to dig at God and religion because they want to be in the side of the devil and uproot truth. No, I think it's a pursuit of truth. And I believe that the scientific pursuit of truth is giving us a proper understanding of what God has always been and has always been known in Kabbalistic circles. So let's move on. God speaks the world into being. All matter, therefore, is essentially sound. The Sefer Yetzirah, which I discussed earlier, is a book which teaches the secrets of the Hebrew alphabet. One of the great sages of the Talmud says that one can look into the Torah, flip it once and flip it twice, for everything is there. It says that if you understand how to combine the letters of the Torah in specific forms and properties, you will be able to manipulate the entire forces of creation. Now think of this. Many people in modern science, subatomic particles aside, look at an atom, neutrons and electrons and all that other stuff, as having a lot of empty space. Okay? Here I got my neutrons and my protons all crumbled up, say, in the size of my fist. And the electrons are out there at the distance of a football field away. There's a whole bunch of empty space in the middle. So therefore, looking at my hand is probably 99.999% in quotes, empty space. If that is true, how come my one hand doesn't go through my other hand? How come the empty space just doesn't go through one to the other? What is hitting? And the answer, science says, are the electrons which provide the electrical field. What do we call an electrical field in Kabbalah? Today it would be called an aura, an energy field. Because in essence, there are other particles in that empty space, but it's not within the realm of the four dimensions that we know as height, width, depth, and time. There are other particles. Remember when God said, let there be light. What is light? Light is the beginning of creation of matter. What existed before the light? Darkness. Now here's a big secret. God doesn't say that he created darkness. He said that the darkness existed before the light. He says, let there be light and let that be separate from the darkness. Where did the darkness come from? It's implied, therefore, that the darkness was there first. What do we call a universe, a world, or particles that travel above the speed of light. Obviously unknown to us in science, it's in the dark. And that's exactly what it is. But no one ever said it doesn't exist. In matter of fact, I believe one physicist, I believe his name is Paul Davies, has written about the pursuit in modern day physics for the faster than light particles, which they call tachyons. But we'll never be able to find them. Why? Because we, in the four dimensions of space-time, which exists, if you will, under the umbrella of light, can't see anything on the other side of it. So therefore, by modern methods of measurement, we will never find it. We can't. But that does not mean it still does not exist. So God, in the beginning, created both. Now here's another interesting thing. We know in the human experience, we have two parts of our mind. We call a conscious self and an unconscious self. In the Torah, we talk about there being a revealed Torah and a concealed Torah. Now we know from the realm of physics that there is a lower than light speed and faster than light speed. But once we're in the dimension of faster than light speed, anything that we understand as propulsion changes. Why? Because we're outside of the dimensions of what we call time and space. Time and space only exist within the concept of lower than light speed. Once you're going faster than that, you're outside of the realm of time and space. Do you know what I've just described to you? Just described to you something which we call heaven. That's what I've just described to you. Heaven. The spiritual plane. The place where our souls come from. In the beginning, our sages teach that Adam was an entity of light. That he had a body of light. And that because of the fall, he fell into the physical body. Where was Adam in the Garden of Eden? What time was it in the Garden of Eden? It doesn't really say, does it? The Bible is inferring that the Garden of Eden actually was a metaphysical place of a body of light. Was it physical? Well, everything is physical. But by what definition and standard do we define physical? Is a TV wave physical? It's made of particles, and the particles exist within the realm of time and space. Maybe I can call that physical. But what about all of these other particles? What is an angel? An angel is an entity, as are demons, entities, which are made up of particles which travel faster than the speed of light. Different from our particles. And therefore, they exist in a different dimension. Going back to the Sefer Yetzirah. The Sefer Yetzirah says that there are actually, well, they say 10 dimensions, as does Kaku, but they sum it up into 5. The first 3 dimensions we all know. Height, width, depth. Fourth dimension is time. Time actually goes in 2 directions, doesn't it? Past and forward. Matter of fact, the 3 dimensions of height, width, depth actually are 6. If you have height, you have depth. Right? If you have width, that means you have right and you have left. If you have depth, it means you have up, you have down. It's really 6. That's how the Sefer Yetzirah counts it. Time, fourth dimension, is really 2. But now you have a 5th dimension. No, it's not the rock and roll band from the 60s. What is the 5th dimension? Which in itself has a scale going from one end to the other. The Kabbalists teach that the 5th dimension is what we will refer to as morality, or good and evil. And the way that you progress up and down that is obviously different than how you would travel in time and space. How do we travel in space? We move ourselves graphically from one point to another, whether it be through my car, whether it be on my feet, we move. How do we move through time? It is something called aging. The more time goes on, it's the only way to move through time, aging. And it's interesting, we can move in all six directions in space, can we not? The way to move on the dimension of morality is towards good and evil. Those are the polarities. And that is through the realm of thought. Now, here is a great secret. What is the vibration of the string? Kabbalists will say it's thought, the power of mind. And when God thought the universe, it came into being. Indeed, the Kabbalists speak of two different creations. Speaks of one which was created in thought, and what which was created in deed. The one which was created in thought is what we call the spiritual universe. The one created in deed is the physical. The Torah that we know in our physical universe begins with the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet, the letter Bet. And our Kabbalists' teachers tell us that the reason why this is so, it's because the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet begins the invisible Torah of the invisible universe. Second letter for the second universe, the first letter for the first. So therefore, there is an entirely parallel dimension governed by the realm of thought, which vibrates those strings at one polarity to manifest space-time, at another polarity to manifest a whole different world. And there are entities of consciousness on those other polarities whose bodies are not made up of neutrons and protons as we know it, but of tachyons and other post-light speed particles that our science does not know. And in their realms, their bodies are as physical as ours in our realm. But how then do our realms meet one another? Well, anybody who's ever been involved in any kind of spiritualism knows that if you're going to meet an angel or a demon, it's not like they're going to knock on your door and walk in and have a beer with you and sit down and watch, you know, whatever. That's not the way it works. But rather, contact is made in a meditative process wherein which the human physical brain disconnects from its sensorial external connection with space-time and goes off into what we might refer to as a dream. In other words, into the realm of mind, into the realm of thought. And there in the realm of thought do you have the common denominator of language, which other beings who also can connect through that realm of thought. And it is known in science that the only thing that can travel faster than light is thought. How did they experiment this? Because when they create antimatter, and you should know antimatter is a real scientific fact. And one of the greatest generators of antimatter is right here in the Chicagoland suburbs. The big generator outside Batavia, along Interstate 88, that big, you know, atom smasher, the big accelerator, where in which particles hit particles and split off, create their opposites. So an electron, which is negative, can create a positron. It's opposite. A proton, which is a positive, can create an antiproton. An antiproton is what we call antimatter. You have all these antiparticles. So therefore, that's still at the sublight level. But at the post-light level, you have all these other particles, all creating their own realities, all creating their own forms, all connected through the realm of thought, which is the vibration of the strings at a different frequency. Strings have no mass. They don't have weight. They just have sound. So here we go, and we see the levels of space. We see the levels of time. We see the levels of morality. A 10-dimensional reality, the Sefiot Sirah speaks of. And here, modern superstring theory thinks this, finds this, and applies the mathematical formulas that science and math does, and it works. gee, maybe those Kabbalists really knew something all these thousands of years. Now, again, if I travel through physical space, I move. I travel through time, I age. I travel through morality, I think. So therefore, I can connect with other universes through the realm of thought. Some refer to it as astral projection. Now, here's a great secret. If Adam originally had a body of light, which was a existence, a form of existence, in one of these post-light universes, we are said that we still exist there, and that we as split beings have an existence in that universe and in this universe, and that our purpose as created beings is to integrate the two worlds. Now that's the great secret. This is what science is right now trying to do. So therefore, can we say science is so anti-God? In essence, they're trying to accomplish the same thing Kabbalists have for years. And the ultimate messianic goal is, we say, death will be no more. There'll be a resurrection of the dead. Life as we know it will change. Everything in the physical realm will change. How? Because we will have connected through the power of mind to a higher dimension, and therefore be able to know how to harmonize the frequency of the strings to transform physical matter. Why do you die? Because the strings which make up your molecular structure dissipate and go in a different direction because something called your soul leaves your body. Now, what really does that mean? The molecular structure of your body doesn't die. Everything in your body is still alive. Every single molecule in your body is alive. It decomposes and takes on other forms, but that couldn't happen if it wasn't alive either. It's definitely alive. Something is in it. That was what we call the fifth dimension, the mind, the soul, life. Kabbalists who meditate on the Hebrew letters and experiment with the sounds, correlate the sounds of the Hebrew letters with the vibrational frequencies of the individual strings of subatomic particles. And by recognizing the name of a thing, rearrange its letters in a meditative form, therefore rearranging the harmony, polarity of the molecular structure, and can change lead to gold, or can traverse 1,000 miles in a moment by warping or folding space, which only exists within this relative dimension. All these things are quite real, and I might add, not science fiction anymore, but outright and true Kabbalah. It is said, again, that the whole Torah is God's name. So we look to the Torah as the formula for the vibrational frequencies of everything in creation. It is the song of the universe. God's name, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, is numerically the value 26 and 10 Sephirot. Why, out of all the numbers of all the dimensions that the scientists could think of, do the numbers only, as Kaku points out, magic numbers, only 10 and 26? Why not 25? Why not 30? 10 and 26. Those numbers only have significance within Hebrew. But now that we understand the nature of creation, that everything is harmony, let's ask the great question. When was the universe created? Well, by Jewish tradition, we are now in the year 5,559 from the birth of Adam. But a point that's made very clear by Rabbi Arya Kaplan in his work called Immortality, Resurrection, and the Age of the Universe, a Kabbalistic view, Adam was not necessarily the first human being. He brings down an ancient teaching from a Rabbi Isaac of the city of Akko, who lived from the years 1250 to 1350. Lived a long time. One of the most ancient Kabbalists, taught many profound, remarkable teachings. There are teachings within Torah, and Rabbi Kaplan, this book documents them very nicely, and I've written about them myself in my Palma Derech, that our present civilization of mankind is not the first, but there were actual full civilizations before ours, which has since evolved and moved on, or destroyed itself and fell. Controversial amongst the Kabbalists, not all Kabbalists hold by it, but many still do. But the question now is asked, well, how old is everything? And we say that our human civilization will last for 7,000 years, the 7 days of creation. But we are only 1 day of a cosmic week. And if our day is 7,000 years, then there is a cosmic week of 7 times 7,000 years. And if we're in the sixth day of the cosmic week, that's a total of 42,000 years. But there's a very interesting verse in the book of Psalms where it says, a day of the Lord is like 1,000 years. So our day, our year is actually 365 1/4 days. A year, if a day of God is 1,000 years, then a year of God would be 365,250 earth years. That would be a year of God. And if the universe existed for 42,000 years before, and those are divine years, not human years, then the age of the universe when this whole process started, Rabbi Kaplan brings down on page 9, quoting Rabbi Yitzhak de Menachem, would be 15,340,500,000 years, which he calls here a highly significant figures. And I quote from his work here. From calculations based on the expanding universe and other cosmological observations, modern science has concluded that the Big Bang occurred approximately 15 billion years ago. But here we see the same figure presented in a Torah source written over 700 years ago. So when fundamentalists want to come and say, the world was created in 6 days, they're absolutely right. And each day was 24 hours long. They're absolutely right. But you want to know something? Go have a talk with Mr. Albert Einstein as to how slow the seconds were ticking on God's clock and how God kept time on his holy Rolex. We judge time today based upon how fast we see things move. So for example, how long would it take for a mountain to be washed into dust before the onslaught of waves? Judging from how we see it happening today, it could take a million years. But that's judging by how we see things today within the limitations of space-time. What would happen if there was a ripple in space-time, a change, and time was, as Einstein says, relative? Then what's 10 minutes might be 10 million years. What is 6 days of 24 hours can equally be 15 billion years. It really all depends on how you look at it. And those are the secrets of cosmology. This is what really happened in the beginning. That we see that it wasn't just God sitting up on a cloud as Michelangelo had painted on the Sistine Chapel, but an entire process of creation, which is very scientific, and which the Kabbalists seem to be very well aware of, judging by the fact that they are able to manipulate the strings, and they are aware of and in communion with some type of life consciousness at the post-light level of creation. And now we have the Torah. Something happened on Mount Sinai. Somehow a connection was made. And somehow, somewhere, knowledge was given. And when we properly understand that the Torah that we have now, that we read in chapters and verses and words and sentences, is only a facade, a outside coat. By going inside and looking into the Torah as a scientific document, and analyzing it from the point of modern-day physics, we will have not only discovered the Torah for the 21st century, we will not only discover the science for the 21st century, we will have discovered that which mankind has craved for the last 100 years. We've already made contact. And we made contact 3,500 years ago. And therefore, this gives Torah an entirely different and new perspective and impetus of importance. So when our sages say, hafuch ba behafuch ba dekula ba, flip it over once and flip it over twice, but all is in it. Now you'll know what all we're talking about. Not just philosophy, not just religious concepts, but the entire structure of a subatomic nature, which defines us and binds us and at the same time limits us. And when we emancipate ourselves from our limitations, we will have achieved what is symbolically referred to as the resurrection of the dead and the coming of the Messiah. So on this note, I'm going to conclude tonight's lecture. We're going to continue, actually, along these same lines in our next few lectures. Next 2 weeks, we're going to discuss topics of angels and demons. Because as I introduced in tonight's topic about post-light particles and post-light entities, we're going to learn about them. Who they are, what they are, where they are, and how they interact with our sublight world.